John Adams, the second president of the United States of America, served one term from 1797 to 1781, and he wrote many letters to his wife, Abigail, that have been recorded for posterity's sake. And John Adams was well known for a very broad library. I say broad because it was probably a big library, contained many books on a broad number of subjects. And in one of the letters that he wrote to his wife, he says, "I read my eyes out, and I can't read half enough. The more one reads, the more one sees how much we need to read." And he also encouraged her to encourage their son, John Quincy Adams, to study history, and to study history and to continue to read. And when he was away and serving the country, he was giving them guidance back home to continue to read and to examine their lives through the lens of the words that they read. And there's so much value that he wanted to convey. And I hope that you also value reading. God speaks to us through his word. It's a written word inspired by him. And as we read, when we read in the Bible, we read about history. We read about its application to the present, and the present, and the future. We know that the Bible contains a record of history. It contains applications now, and a significant percentage of it is presenting events that have never occurred yet, that still are yet to occur. So hopefully we can read the Bible, read the Word on a regular basis, and benefit from that. Reading history, reading biographies, reading books helps to expand our minds. I like to think of an author as a tour guide that takes my mind places that I would have never even known to go or thought of going. It's nice that with the process of editing, many times what we get when we read a book on a quality topic from a quality author, I'll throw in a couple of disclaimers there because not all material is worth reading. But when we do have a subject from a knowledgeable, capable, reputable author on something that's constructive and beneficial to us, we get their best thoughts in that book. They're distilled and they've been edited down for us, and there's something that they wanted to share, and we have opportunity to access that. If it's a history book, then we read about the events that occurred. We might read about the context in which they occurred. We might read about the decisions that were made, and with enough time, we can also see the outcomes of those decisions and whether they were positive or worthy of reconsideration. And perhaps different decisions would have been made in hindsight, and perhaps they changed or pivoted or iterated on those previous decisions later in life. So it helps us to gain perspective. Reading of previous people in previous times helps us to learn through others. When I was a teenager, I was sitting in an audience like that, and I heard a man come up here and give a sermonette, and he was well known for these pithy, memorable sayings. And he said, "You can learn from experience and be wise, or others and be happy." That was Wayne Speed, and he was sharing in a message called The School of Hard Knocks how he had learned from some of his life experiences, and if he were to rewrite the narrative again, he probably wouldn't have made some of the mistakes that he did, but he did learn from them. So his point was that when we can learn vicariously through others, sometimes We can avoid mistakes. And the Bible gives us the record of the lives of humans that obeyed God and his directives and benefited and were blessed, and families were blessed as a result, and then times when some didn't, and then the consequences of those decisions as well. All great learning experiences for us. One thing that we learn when we read of the narratives and stories of others and their lives and the outcomes, when we read of people's lives and events that have preceded us, it helps us to learn something and recognize something very valuable. We start to learn to recognize patterns. Because patterns do repeat themselves. We have quoted before, and perhaps it's applicable here, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. By Mark Twain, another man known for pithy, memorable sayings, he was recognizing that history may not repeat itself exactly, but there were and are patterns. And so this is a little mixtape, personal mixtape of Mark Twain and Socrates, some thoughts that I have framed after reading multiple books, and that is that words seek to convey information and influence from people and are sometimes somewhat reliable, depending on who they are and their character. Actions speak louder. And yet patterns of thought and behavior are absolutely reliable. We can see and learn patterns. We go through different seasons in life, and as I look out here, I see different seasons of life that people are living in and experiencing, and they all have their own different perspectives and challenges and opportunities, and it's wonderful to consider all of the different seasons of life. It seems like we also learn things at different times of life, maybe just for fun. I'll ask how you would have felt if Mr. Guzman's pop quiz was on history. How many people love history? How many people are perspiring right now as we even think about it? Some don't like history. There's certain things I don't love about history. One is how the dates are so random. The dates and events are so random. It's not structured. Sometimes major events happen 11 years apart, sometimes four, sometimes two. And if you're trying to put the dates in order, it can get challenging to keep it all straight. And then you have multiple parallel timelines occurring at the same time. I will say also that it was somewhere around 40 or so that I started really appreciating and becoming more interested in history. And recently, I've been doing a lot of reading on history, particularly church history, going back to the first century church. Just so happens that in the Bible reading program that I'm doing, I'm in Acts right now, which is the inception of the New Testament church. So we're going through the events of the first Christian churches. They were referred to Christians for the first time in Acts and the church in Antioch. And so we see the inception of the church that we are a continuation of today. And the church throughout history, as we consider the believers who believed in the words as they were taught, and we went through some of the attributes of that church through all of the generations of time on the last day of unleavened bread. But as we go through those, we recognize that there were certain patterns. There are certain patterns that start to show up century after century after century. And as we read the narratives, we read even in the Bible, we can read the history of Israel, and we know that there were patterns. You can think about the patterns of obedience and disobedience, and then trials and tribulations, back to obedience, bad kings and prophets. Prophets were good. They were messengers from God. The messages that we hear from God through the prophets were good, but not all kings wanted to hear them. And then when they would start to listen, usually through events and circumstances that got their attention, then the country would do well again, or the nation of Israel would do well, and then they would go up and down on those cycles. So as we consider where we are now, 30 years from the initial General Conference of Elders held in Indianapolis in 1995, here we are 30 years later as the United Church of God. We can go back a little further in our local history. We can go back 60 years of the Church of God here in Phoenix. So it was 1965 that a Church of God was established here in Phoenix under the adjectives Worldwide Church of God. And then we can also go back, and as it was stated, there's a pattern that exists throughout time, even of modern church history, and that is that every 15 years there is a crisis. And if we look back, the last one was in 2010. So if you do the math, we're due. But I hope that doesn't happen. That's why we're going to be fasting and praying and hoping that and praying that God is involved and that we don't have a crisis. But we do see a pattern there. So we see this pattern. We see these patterns. And I recently read a book by the author Gary Petty. Some of you have heard of him. And he's a fantastic teacher, and I enjoyed reading his books. We might have listened to his sermon, but now he's written a couple of books. And Plato's Shadow is one that he published some time ago. And it's a book about the Hellenization of Christianity. And to Hellenize something is to put it under the Greek influence. So something that is Hellenized has been influenced by Greek philosophies and teaching. And Rome was very much Hellenized. The Grecian Empire was in power for several centuries before Rome, and so Rome was fascinated by the Greek teaching, and they would bring Greek teachers and philosophers to teach their kids. And so while each kingdom had their strengths, they also had their belief systems, and their belief systems were fabricated to address the great questions that they had in life. And some of them, you might say, rhymed with the biblical narrative, but many of them were out there a bit. And yet, those ideas came in and influenced the church. It was a theme of Christ's teaching to be careful of false teachers. It was a theme of all of the epistles or letters that we read from the pastors of the time, the pastoral epistles, that warned against these different ideas coming into the church and polluting the truth that they worshiped. So it was a good book. My goal was to read it on the flight to Cincinnati. I thought, I'll have to be very focused to do this, but this is my goal. I'll have a couple of hours here, and I'll read this book. And I wouldn't have made it. We did have a four-hour layover, it turned out, in Nashville. So after a very nice dinner with the Kohlers, or lunch with the Kohlers, who just happened to be on the plane, we had lunch, and then I got into the book, and with the layover, got very close, within 20 pages or so of finishing it, and finished it over the weekend. And we just continually, there's this pattern that repeats itself of expansion of a church, and then teachings that start to come in that create a falling away. So we know this as the church expansion, and then what comes in? What's another rather fancy word for false teachings? Heresy. And heresy leads to apostasy, which is the falling away. So you might want to read that as well. Plato's Shadow, very nice book. And then he's recently written another book called Christendom, The Kingdom That Changed Christianity. So he takes it from that Hellenistic Roman period, takes the New Testament church through the Habsburg Empire several centuries later. So it's a very approachable read on church history. As a congregation, we have read the Epistle of Ephesians. And that was a letter to a New Testament church in the city of Ephesus. And we gleaned much from what Ephesus was going through because there's so much written about Ephesus. And we were able to learn very much from that. We've read the letters from Jesus Christ himself to the seven churches of Revelation and considered how the patterns of thought and behavior that were evident at that time show up in the church today. We considered how we can benefit from the commendations that Christ made for the attributes of those church congregations that were positive. We also learned from the correction that he gave to those churches. We were also encouraged by the instruction that he gave. He gave them the instruction to overcome those elements that could otherwise keep them from the reward that God has in store for them, an inheritance in his eternal family as he wants for them. So we've gone through that in detail. Last week at the GCE, we heard many autobiographical accounts of the events leading up to the massive church split in 1995. And as we've just reviewed, the heretical or false teachings that led to the mass apostasy or falling away in 1995, it's interesting that in this context, heretical has the connotation of being against the orthodoxy. So from our perspective, from our lens, we see the teachings that came in as heretical. What do most Christian churches and teachings consider heretical? That which we teach. Keeping the Sabbath at the Laodicean conference was considered heresy. Keeping Passover once a year on the 14th was considered heretical, and the heretics had to be put out of the church. So it's interesting to see how those tables can be turned, and the term heresy in actuality would be anything that's contrary to God's truth, but they would brand those that are God-fearers. That was another name of those that obeyed God throughout time, are God-fearers, those that respect and fear and worship and obey God. And those that kept the truths, as we've defined them, of the Church of God were always branded heretics. Again, we learn that, and it's instructive for us to consider that as we move forward in time, that pattern is going to be present again. We will see all of this occur again. The pattern continues to repeat itself. If you're interested in that church story, I'd like to share with you that Victor Kubik has documented the narrative from his perspective on his website, kubik.org, in a series that now has 13 different installments called Ground Zero. Last week, he gave the Bible study, presented the Bible study on the morning of the Sabbath, and he went through the narrative from his perspective, which is well informed because he was the assistant to the director of ministerial services. Member in ministerial services is what we would call it today. So he was in church administration, and at the time they were full of offices, so his desk was actually in the same office as the director of church administration. So he heard and experienced firsthand what was happening from 1990 through 1995 when the eventual bifurcation occurred. So you might be interested in that. I also read recently a far more recent, just brand new published book on church history. In the Bible, in the canonized Bible, we call this the canon, there are how many books? Say it loud. Just send it out there. You may be wrong, you may be right, I may be crazy. How many? Did I hear 66? Okay. 66 is correct. How many authors are there? 37. We can say 37 is probably the best number that we know definitively, and it could be 40-ish, and it could actually be a few more, because what we don't know of is whether, say, Hebrews had multiple authors, or some books may have had more than one author, or there may have been a scribe involved who was also very knowledgeable that helped write the book. So we can just say 40-ish. The book that I recently read has 66 authors. Not 66 books, but 66 authors. And it contains the narrative of 111 believers. It's very instructive. It's the sequel to a book that was written 10 years ago that contained 37 biographies. And there's an update on 17 of the 37 in the new book, because several, 20, passed since the time that the book was produced between the two productions. So here we have these books, the senior biographies, 2015 and 2025. And these are significant books documenting the faithful in our local congregations. These books share life experiences and wisdom from lives lived in pursuit of God's way. That way that's mentioned multiple times, seven times in Ephesians. The way. It's mentioned in Acts as well. And these stories illuminate lessons learned from lives lived walking the way. They pass on the nuggets of wisdom learned from life's experiences in the Word. And they can be a tremendous blessing to us. This book is very valuable as a result. It shows the end of the matter. It shows the end of the story. Now, I'm not trying to put some of you into a grave and you think, hey, I barely made it. I'm 70. I've got a few years left. So I'm not trying to say that you're about to die, but you're in a season where you can pass on the nuggets of wisdom and from the life that you've learned, lived, and have learned from. Most lived for the sequel, by the way. So there's a good chance that the 2035 book will also contain the next chapter in your stories as well. This book shows that the end of the matter is better than the beginning. Let's take a look in Ecclesiastes, where we read of another biography, one that wasn't included in this book, but is also very instructive and informative for us. It reads also teaches us the life lessons of another man who learned much and observed much and set his heart to study patterns of thoughts and behaviors and shares them with us through this book. So as we turn to Ecclesiastes, we are turning to a book that's included in the section of the Bible that we refer to as the wisdom literature. And we read of some of the wisdom that Solomon is sharing with us. And as we put this together, we'll start in verse 8 and then we'll go to verse 1. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 8, and then verse 1. Ecclesiastes 7, 8 captures this timeless truth. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. And then we pick up what we might refer to as Ecclesiastes 7:1b, the second half of Ecclesiastes 7:1. The day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. How might that be true? That seems like an odd perspective, that the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Well, the day of one's death gives us the opportunity to look back on their lives, to consider their contributions, to consider their life story. I like how we've changed the nomenclature associated with funerals to celebrations of life or memorials, because we remember at this point what they've done, some of the highlights of their lives and the things that they valued, and we are able to look back and see that. So we have here with the senior biography, we have the thoughts of those that are in this congregation and in Northern Arizona and in Phoenix East, and we're able to see you, and we have opportunity to talk to you now. We have, and I borrow this from the subtitle on the cover of the book, the memories and moments over time who by God's blessing have accumulated 70 years, and if by reason of strength, 80 years, and many have passed the 70 mark, being very blessed with long age. Does anybody know what a score is? How do you spell it? Well, in English, S-C-O-R-E. In Old Norse, S-K-O-R. S-K-O-R. And a score means a notch. And so when they were counting sheep or cattle or livestock or anything, they would put a notch in a stick for every 20. So then they would count to 20, which, by the way, is not saying that anything about the Old Norse, but that's as many fingers and toes as you have, and then you could make a notch and start all over again. So who knows how they did all that, but that's where it came from. So this book and the Bible encourage us to honor the elderly. It gives us an opportunity to do that, to fulfill the encouragement that we're given in the Bible. So let's take a look in the Bible at where it says that we should honor and pay attention to the elderly. Let's turn to Proverbs 16. Proverbs 16, 31, verse 31 says, "The silver-haired head is a crown of glory." That's a wonderful visual image, that the gray hair is a crown. If it is obtained in the way of righteousness. And we might replace if with especially when it is obtained in a through a life of righteousness. Let's turn over to Proverbs 20. We read another scripture about the value of gray hair and what a blessing it can be. And yet it's valued differently. We talked about the different seasons of life that we're in, and we see the world and we experience it differently as we go through these different seasons, and that's okay. Proverbs 20 speaks to this notion as we pick it up here in verse 29. The glory of young men is their strength. And we recognize this. We even all collectively see the accomplishments of younger men and women, their athletic accomplishments, their records. Maybe we watch the Olympics and we see the swimming or the gymnastics events, and we see records being broken and we cheer that on. Here locally, we have a City League basketball team, and we encourage them as they do their best to play and develop the teamwork necessary to be successful. Our young people in school, as they accomplish musically and athletically and the different things that they're going through, and we'll be doing that next week, even as graduates reach a milestone of eighth grade or high school or college or grad school, and that this is their glory as they're growing and accomplishing. And then there's a different glory of getting older, and it refers here to this in Proverbs 20:29b, and the splendor of old men, and we'll say and women, is their gray head. So it's a different value that those that are older, and as the colors change, as the seasons change, we recognize that there's not many gray heads out there on the basketball court or in the Olympic swimming pools or doing flips and tricks on the bars and the beam. Not the uneven beam, that would be interesting. The uneven bars and the beam during the Olympics. Not a lot of gray heads out there unless they're the coaches. And that's really the point, is that at some point we become coaches. At some point we transition and we provide value in a different way, and the value is to pass on the knowledge, skills, experience, and wisdom gained over time, the perspective, recognizing thoughts and patterns, and sharing those perspectives and the observation of thoughts and patterns. I've appreciated over time having mentors in different categories. And from time to time, I'll make a phone call and I'll say, can we talk? Or can we get together? Sure, come on over. And then we'll either sit down, sometimes now it's via Zoom or sometimes it's in person, but we'll have a chat and I will lay out what seems like a chessboard and putting all the pieces in place on the chessboard, and then my mentor or advisor in this situation will look at it, and without even having to know the individuals or the people, it's like there's a recognition of all the players on the chessboard and their positions and their patterns, and they might bring clarity to whatever the topic of discussion is. And then I can fold it all up, say, thank you, you've helped me think through what's going on here and what the implications of different options are. And this has been very valuable. So those conversations have occurred many times, and they have wisdom from their knowledge and experience that can be very valuable to a younger man. And it's also a pleasure and a blessing to share life experiences with those of you who are going through phases of life where you can benefit from that. And this is personal. This is my personal experience, yet this is replicated throughout the congregations as you do the same thing for each other. In fact, we're encouraged to do this. In fact, this is by God's design, and we can consider this as we turn to Titus. And in Titus, the book of Titus, we're reading a letter from a mentor, Paul, to a mentee, Titus, who was a pastor, and he was being sent to the island of Crete, and that was his assignment. So he had multiple churches on the island of Crete. How many of you would like that assignment? It would be all of you if you'd been to the feast in Crete last year, because it was beautiful, temperate, great food. Kaylee wants to go back there and live. So in Titus 2, we're reading of this encouragement to Titus. Paul says, here's what you should do. Here's the type of environment you should encourage. Speak the things that are proper for sound doctrine. In other words, go and teach the truth. Teach them the truth, and teach the older men to be sober or serious-minded, not intoxicated by the different winds of cultural trends and the Greek philosophies that are contrary to the truth, but teach them the truth and encourage them to be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, and in patience. These are attributes that we gain over time. Maybe those adjectives don't describe some of us when we're younger, and over time, come to describe us more as we grow and mature and develop and are seasoned through life experiences, marinated in life's experiences, tenderized through life's experiences. That's a kind of a progressive thought process, isn't it? Seasoned, marinated, and tenderized, progressively more involved. You know what a tenderized steak looks like? It looks like it's been through the grinder. And that's how we look like over time, right? It happens to us all. We look different, but we feel different, and we're changed as a result of those experiences. And so Paul's encouraging Timothy to assign value to those characteristics because they're valuable and they can be shared and passed on. In verse 3, we move to the older women. Likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers. So they're careful with their speech and their tongue to be encouraging and to use it properly as we're encouraged in other parts of the Bible, to be edifying. Does anybody know what edifying means? To build up. So that they should be not slanderers, not given to much wine, careful in that regard, and teachers of good things. And that there be this intergenerational interaction as well. That they admonish the young women to love their husbands. They may need a reminder from time to time because the husbands aren't where they will be in 30 or 40 years either. And so it may be necessary for an older woman to say, just love him. He'll get there. Stick with it. He'll get there. He'll be seasoned and marinated and tenderized over time. To love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers and supportive of their husbands and contributing to their families and good, and that they can provide input into the marriages and the challenges that are associated with that as well. And so here we read of a biblical encouragement for this intergenerational element to occur. So how can we apply these principles and honor God in our congregations? How can we apply what we're learning here, learn God's ways, and grow together as a congregation? I have a challenge for you all. If you are not in this book, if your picture and your story is not in this book, then I challenge you to do this. Go through this book on a weekly basis. We may need some more copies of this. But to go through this book on a weekly basis and pick one person and read their story and find them and have a conversation with them at services. This is going to take diligent effort. It's going to require that we step outside our comfort zone. And yet, there will be tremendous value if you take on this challenge. You will find it very valuable. Those that are in the book will find a valuable opportunity to share with you their life experiences. There's 111 biographies in here, so this could be a 2-year project for you. You may want to double up. The ambitious might double up and do it in a year. There are 94 new biographies. There are 17 updates. There were 37 last time. 20 aren't here with us. This may make you want to think about how you prioritize your list. Some won't be with us in 10 years. You won't have the opportunity afterward. You can go back and read their biographies, but it won't be as meaningful as talking to them and hearing their stories now. It can be conversations here at services. That's sometimes hard to do because things are moving and we only have limited time, and so we have surface-level conversations at church. But get together outside of church. Set up a visit. Meet for coffee or desserts or whatever it is. get together in a different way. So you can do it through calls and visits and cards and prayers. You can pray for each other and those specifically in this book. It's been a blessing for me personally to get to know many of you at a much deeper level over the past 5 and 6 years now, as I've had opportunity to serve in this role. It's created more opportunities to get to know you in a better way, and I'm blessed as a result. So I want to pass this on to you, you all who are younger, to receive that same blessing. My mom's twin, Aunt Jackie, or Aunt Jack, as we've called her, is a nurse. And she graduated from nursing school circa 1970, 1972. And she did her rotations at a hospital that some of you know well. It's referred to as Boswell. And so she did her rotations at Boswell, where she cared for the constituency that Boswell serves, the residents of Sun City, for the most part. And so she cared for those at that time that were in the last season or the last part of the season of their lives. And she said it was such a wonderful opportunity at that time of life to learn and see the sum of the results of people's choices and lives and how so many had made so many good choices, and here they are finishing well. And they would have stories to tell and things to pass on. It's also interesting that circa 2022, so 50 years later, Aunt Jackie's great niece, Kaylee, who is a great niece, her great niece, Kaylee, did her rotations at Boswell and also had that opportunity with her aunt's encouragement to get to know some of those patients and to benefit in the same way. This is also in alignment with the vision of the United Church of God today. The United Church of God, the vision of the United Church of God is to be a church led by God's Holy Spirit, joined and knit together by what every member supplies, with they all doing their part to bring forth God's great purpose for humanity, to bring many children to glory. God is love, and this is one way that we can show love towards each other, is to give everyone the opportunity to contribute to each other. It will take effort. It will be uncomfortable. That's why it's a challenge. That's why I encourage you to do this. Let's, as we deconstruct that vision statement, we read, What every member supplies. The implication is that all are important, with all doing their share. Let's give all the opportunity to contribute in unique ways. Now, this older generation has contributed to the younger generation. They have made room on speaking schedules and song leading schedules for the younger generation to have opportunity to be here and to contribute. They may have talents and abilities that are still very useful, and yet they will make room so that the next generation can grow and develop their talents and abilities. And we can honor and respect that by asking them about their life stories. One of the first conversations I had with someone in the elderly category, an octogenarian woman who is highly respected, she's no longer with us now, she said to me, sadly at one point, she said, "I feel like a bump on a log. I come to services, but but I don't feel like I contribute to anybody in any way. And so, in an attempt to offer encouragement, I said, well, just you being there sends a message. Doris Laurent is in this first biography booklet, and she would sit there in a wheelchair in the back and never miss services. And when you would talk to her, she somehow always gave you a gift. I'm praying for you. Love you. Hope you're doing well. So just the presence alone can be a gift. But then also there's so much more that can be passed on if we'll just take the time and ask. So, as we mentioned, there's a biography that's not in this book, but is in ours, and it's written by Solomon. As we turn back to Ecclesiastes, I'll just highlight a few things for you. As we read of Ecclesiastes toward the end of Solomon's life, and we consider what he wanted to pass on. In Ecclesiastes 1:1, he says, "Vanity of vanities, says the preacher or teacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." So, looking up that word, trying to understand better what it means, I revealed that it's from the Hebrew root word that we would probably pronounce Hebel, but they would probably pronounce something like Hebel, something we wouldn't recognize, say, ourselves. But what it means is, or could be translated as also, is a breath or a mist. Every once in a while, not very often in Phoenix, but if we travel up north, it might be cold enough for us to blow a little breath out there and see our breath. We can see our breath. It's cold. And we see it. And how long does it stay there? Does the whole room or outside fill up with smoke because everybody's breath is showing up? No, it dissipates quickly, doesn't it? And that's what Solomon is saying our life is like. It's like that. It shows up and disappears so quickly. It's very often that the Jews will read Ecclesiastes during a specific festival or time of year. Does anybody know what that festival or time of year is? Say it loud. Feast of Tabernacles. At a time when everyone's dwelling in temporary dwellings, considering how temporal this life is and how we're pilgrims in this life, Ecclesiastes is read. It's read that this life is a vapor and it comes and it goes. And it's a great time to be reminded of that because we're living in temporary dwellings. We are now, as we occupy these physical bodies, they have an expiration date. They don't live forever. 70 is the biblically allotted amount, if by reason of strength, 80, and some all the way into 70, but rarely, very rarely, does one hit 50, and there's probably a few. I think there's some on the Social Security books that are at much higher, but different subject. So we live in temporary dwellings at the feast, and by the way, I'll say, don't let that lesson get lost. We save our income and we go to the feast and we live in nice places, typically in nicely appointed condos, hotels, or resorts. We tend to rent a car and so we get a newer car, which by default might be nicer than our car. And we think, oh, this is the way it should be. The reminder at the feast and the reason that we live in temporary dwellings is the reminder that the millennium is coming and that we are temporary in this tent and that all of this is going to go away. So to live in temporary dwellings that aren't as nice as our homes would be really more appropriate, and that's the biblical instruction, is to live in a place where you can see through the roof. You can see the stars. Maybe like sleeping in a tent, but without the rain cover on. You can see through, see what's happening up there. So just a point. But a point that's made here in Ecclesiastes as well is that we're temporary. 2 Peter 1:10. 2 Peter 1:10 says, "Be diligent to make your calling and election sure." So Peter is near the end of his life and he's writing to the congregations that he serves and he says, make sure you pay careful attention to the invitation that you've been given and fulfill your role in the self-examination necessary, making the changes necessary to align with God and His Word. And he says then, I will remind you with this always. In other words, you've heard me say this over and over and over again, and I'm going to say it again, and you may roll your eyes, but I don't care. I'm going to say it as long as I'm in this tent, he says. As long as I'm in this tent, this physical, temporary dwelling that I'm in now, I'm going to remind you of this. I'm going to be careful to ensure that you hear these words in your ears, even after I'm gone, that you have a reminder when I depart. That's what Peter said. He wanted to be sure that he did say things over and over again. Because life is temporary, it's short, and things change, and so we want to be aware of that. We can read in this book the lives of those who faithfully obeyed God, did their best to the end. We read of Paul and Peter and James and John. And Paul's words were, I fought the good fight. I finished my race. It's time for me to go. I'm encouraging you to fight your fight, to fight your battles, to live your life, to learn from our lives. And Paul knew that he had made mistakes in his life. And he shared them openly so that others could learn from them. We also read of Saul and Solomon, who made mistakes. Old Testament Saul, New Testament Saul. Solomon, who made their mistakes. We're reading his words in Ecclesiastes now. And he's, in hindsight, saying, this is worthy of paying attention to. You can read this on your own. It might be a good homework assignment for you this afternoon to read all of Ecclesiastes in this context. In the context of today, in the context of our recently published biographies booklets, in the context of us living in a temporary life. Read in chapter 3 that there's a time for everything. There's a time to be born and a time to die, it says in Ecclesiastes 3:2. There's a time to be born and a time to die. We bless babies in our congregation every year, and what an awesome opportunity it is to see these little ones come up here and receive a prayer and a blessing in their lives. And we also, as we will today, and as we did last Friday for Jim Bosler, and as we will next week and or 2 weeks from now in Northern Arizona for Lola Lee, we say goodbye. And today we'll say goodbye to Don Davidson and we'll remember his life. And there's an appointed time for each of these major events. And then along the way, there's a time to plant and a time to harvest, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. And so you can read about those different elements. And as we move through the book, we've already read in Ecclesiastes 7 that better is the end than the beginning. Does this mean that as we read these words that Ecclesiastes is nihilistic and that all is for nothing and there's no hope? No, it's quite the opposite of that. It contains real observations. And it may seem like it's coming from a pessimistic perspective, yet even that can be valuable. I wouldn't describe it as pessimistic, perhaps realistic. And basically, it's realistic in saying that without God and without His greater purpose for this life, it would be meaningless, absolutely meaningless. We just live and die because things just come and go. But when we recognize that this life is our opportunity to grow and become like our elder brother, Jesus Christ, like a member of the family, God family, with the help of God's Holy Spirit, to be transformed, converted into becoming like them so that they say, well done, good and faithful. You did your best with what you had when you had time to do it, and now I want you to be a part of our eternal family. First person God speaking here. That's what we read about in the Bible. That's the opportunity that we have. And when we take opportunity to get to know those who have the crown of the gray head, we have opportunity to get to know those who said by their presence here and by their lives and their examples that there is nothing else worth it over time. There is no diversion and there is no distraction that's worth it. At one point in our history, 90% thought something else was more important. And we're the remnant of the 10%, 30 years later. What a blessing it is to be here. So a couple last encouragements in conclusion from Solomon. Verse 9 of chapter 9. In an earlier season, he says, "Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life," or of your temporal life, your life that's like a breath, it's going to come and go quickly, "which he has given you under the sun," all of these temporary days. In verse 10, "whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." Go all in. Give it your best shot, we might say. Learn what you can, contribute what you can. "For there is no wisdom or device or knowledge in the grave where you are going." You'll eventually get there, he's saying. And then we turn over to 11, Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9. "Rejoice, O young man," O young person, young man, young woman, "in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth, when you have your strength and your vitality. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that God will judge you." So use your enthusiasm and the drive that you have now to propel you to contribute. Stay healthy spiritually, emotionally, physically. Know this, that time and talents that God gives you are something that he will expect a return on. He's going to expect a return on what he has given you, and he's given you time and talents. We read of the parable of the talents. What will you do with what he has given you? Well, you might benefit by framing it in the lives of those who have gone before us and understanding what they did and maybe what they would say they wouldn't have done if they were to do it all over. Maybe we can produce a higher return by benefiting from that perspective. And then we jump to chapter 12. "Remember now your Creator, in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, 'I don't have any pleasure in them.'" And then he goes through some metaphorical ways that that happens. The windows grow dim. The grinders cease. The teeth wear out. We read about prayer requests for dentures are coming, all the teeth are getting pulled, and so it happens. The strong men bow down. A man's strength dissipates over time. And so we read about these things as they happen. And then we get to verse 13, the conclusion of the chapter. "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." There's tremendous blessing in learning from the lives of those who have gone before us. And we have an opportunity in our multi-generational congregation to experience that benefit. We can see the world through a more mature lens when we have conversations and develop relationships in that way. We can learn from what we read and what we hear, and we can come to understand why the end of a thing is better than the beginning.